I'm talking about the buttressing. This buttressing may be after Minerva has flown, but he sees that there's a buttressing in the 19th century against the new electric environment, the telegraph environment. He's saying we're now buttressing the, back 50 years ago, we're buttressing the industrial environment against the software environment. Just...
Yeah, so it's the reverse rim spin or the... Yeah, okay. So exactly as you said, he's struggling to find that that calculus or language that he comes back, you know, center margins, not center margins, front spin, back spin.
Yep, rim spins. Yep. Okay, so he's saying there's buttressing going on in the 20th century, but there's not much... of that buttressing in the 2nd century AD, 5th century BC, and the 16th. I don't know if he would say that later. He's thinking that they're more in harmony, the different dynamics, the battle between the civilization and the barbarians. But I think he's mixing up the romanticism of the Renaissance period with... before he sees the harsh laws of technical of environmental effects, which Innes helped him articulate.
Yeah, I don't know. Or maybe the next post will give us clues in that. I don't think we're going to get any more from this one.
Okay, so the last line is, the earwig, when bisected, fights itself. So with the arts. Now, the earwig, you know what that is.
Oh, I know that there's the Humphrey Chipton earwig or whatever from... we've got Finnegan's Wake references in there.
That's right. The earwig is one of the main images around Humphrey Chipton earwicker. The earwig is a phenomenon in Finnegan's Wake. So it's interesting he's got Finnegan's Wake on his mind. Now, he also... that means he hasn't figured out Finnegan's Wake. And by 53, he can say Finnegan's Wake dealt with the media as art forms. Now, that's a pretty amazing statement in 1953. Yep. He can't make that statement in 49, 48. He hasn't got Innes to clarify that for him. You see, when Innes shows up, he now has a media environmental knowledge base to really stand back and realize that radio created Finnegan's Wake. And that Finnegan's Wake was wrestling with that and dealt with the different media as art forms. So you got to realize, media as art forms. He's saying that in the 70s in the famous, what's that interview with the Hydro, the Forces magazine.
Yep.
The Forces magazine. Really good interview where he says the media are art forms. That's 20 years after he wrote it. And that's such a big statement. Finnegan's Wake... is about Joyce treating the media as art forms. He doesn't have the data really to prove that. He begins with occasional article in radio and TV in the absent-minded in Explorations. But it's not till Eric and he really get analyzing and figure out the thunders that he can sort of back it up with humanist detail. You know what I mean? Here's McLuhan fighting himself. The earwig, when bisected, fights itself. So with the arts. So does that mean that?
I don't get what the allusion to earwig. I think I'm missing some of the mythological significance of earwigs.
Well, I guess when it gets cut in two, it's still the parts fight each. It's sort of like that thing you cut off the tail of and it grows its tail back. Begins with N, whatever that little newt, the newt or something.
Mm-hmm.
We could quickly look it up on Wikipedia, but let's assume that when you cut the earwig in two, it still moves around fighting itself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. He's talking about the division in the sciences between the C.S. Lewis dialectic of the fight between the two cultures, science and the humanities. So you have this fight going on. And the 19th century history and critics, so they'd be the humanists, buttress themselves with prestige of Dom against science and technology. And it happens again, but he had figured out a way to unite them, to bring the circle of art, the circle of the arts intact by moving on to another level of the spiral, the media's art forms. A new ground can retrieve the circle of arts. It becomes a circle of media and put them intact. And no longer will the 19th century specialists divide itself. Because, you know, he's saying the scientists and the humanists are on the, are based on the same ground, but they don't see it. So it fights itself.
Yep, yep. No, I'm following it.
All right, so he sees the new Esperanto, the new, he said jazz was the Esperanto. Here was the blacks, Louis Armstrong and that with jazz in the 20s and 30s, united the world. And then the subculture of literacy attempted to bring back the global culture of black music back into the literate subculture under something called civil rights. So the Esperanto of music is what Marshall's seeing that television is. Media Esperanto. There was a unity in the global theater. The communication ecology, the circle of the media is intact once again. Humpty Dumpty's back together.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so we go on to the next. And we finished, that's Andrews, February 8th, 2011.
Yep, so what's the next one? A massive Bauhaus program of haptic innovation?
Yeah, that sounds good. That's a quote from, I guess, something Marshall wrote. Now, this is a long one, but let's see how we... But maybe this will be easy because it's getting into the 50s. When you get into the 50s, it's easier to analyze his scribblings because they're not stuck in his own earwig fighting himself in his own professorial tradition, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's still trying. He writes, you found some of these notes in the late 40s. He's saying, maybe I will dare to cite Wyndham Lewis. Maybe I will quit teaching.
Yeah, become the one-man circus on campus or something like this. Yeah, yeah.
Right. He's still not sure if he can pull it off. Okay, so... But see, that shows you when television came in, he quickly realized, wow, this changes everything, right? It's so different, television.
Yeah, let's move on. It's we're looking at February 16, 2011.
And it's titled A Massive Bauhaus Program of Haptic Innovation. Now, what's interesting, you don't hear C. Marshall using the word haptic too often. Right? So it's always interesting when he brings that word in. So Andrew has Inscripto 10. Would this be the 10th item? I assume it is.
Oh, presumably.
Yeah, December 2010 has 4. January has 5. That's 9. And then the earwig would be 10. It's actually number 11 if you count them that way. This is the 11th date. So he says, the following is a transcription of a speech which Marshall McLuhan delivered to the Learned Society's Canada Conference in Montreal in June 1961. So this is going to be pretty, this is later McLuhan.
Yep.
No, we've dropped the literary guy.
Just as a footnote, the only other record I've got of McLuhan, using haptic before this was, it's also in 61 in his correspondence with Edward T. Hall.
Okay, so Andrew says, I was only going to type out a few bits and pieces, but have decided that just to pull a few quotes would be to damage the whole. Even though parts are decidedly outdated and probably won't make much sense outside of 1961, as with a lot of Marshall's writing, there's much that is still completely relevant and perhaps surprisingly so. Now, I've read this before. I remember thinking, well, after I read the talk, you know, the transcription, there's nothing... outdated, unless just naming President Kennedy is outdated. You know, just who President Kennedy is. Maybe that's what he means, but I don't know. This is a pretty interesting excerpt. So, Andrew says, by publishing a complete text like this, I'm going outside my stated objective of providing just a glimpse. However, I'm not going to let that limit me, this time anyway. In other words, it's too good, right? I am encouraging a critic to say that I write too much per post. What's that mean? I'm also encouraging a critic to say that I write too much per post. I'm not saying he's writing too much, are you?
No, write more all the time. We want more. We want total access to the library because it's so incredible.
Yeah, and he's thinking the assumption that people don't have time to read, you know, read long things. Well, that might be true in the texting world, but it ain't true for a lot of people's lives. They got a lot of time on their hands. It's just that does he have the time to type it all out? Okay, so he apologized for writing too much. In the following, as in a lot of Marshall's work, one can see how important his library, rather other authors, were to Marshall. Okay, so here we go. Quote, when President Kennedy was newly elected, the editor of the Christian Science Monitor said to Philip Dean, now Philip Dean was a Greek guy who was around McLuhan in the late 50s, early 60s, and seemed to be a confidant of Marshall McLuhan. You know, Philip Dean, you've seen that name before?
Yes.
Yeah. The editor of the Christian Science Monitor said to Philip Dean, quote, we now have our first beatnik president, unquote. I am sure that when I was chosen as guest speaker for this occasion, many felt inspired to observe that, quote, we now have our first beatnik guest speaker. Now, why would McLuhan think he was seen that way? It would seem that around Toronto, McLuhan was already seen to be a loose cannon in the 50s by Patrick Watson or people at CBC, the people that had met him in local events, cultural events. They knew what he really was. But when you saw pictures of McLuhan, I remember the Canadian Architect magazine. There's an architect magazine. He does it might even be this, but it's a long article. And they have a picture of McLuhan, and you don't see anybody looking as conservative as McLuhan looks like. He looks very conservative in the late 50s, early 60s pictures. Not the guy in The Mechanical Bride.
Ginsberg never looked wild as well. Well, he did kind of in later life, but Ginsberg frequently looked, you know, suits, you know, that sort of casual suit kind of thing.
Yeah, but he would have no. That's the beatnik was you got the beatnik image and then you have the hippie image, and Ginsberg did both. That may be true in the early 50s, but not when he's showing up. When he did Howl, he did San Francisco in the nude, took his clothes off. Now, McLuhan wasn't taking his clothes off. I just find it interesting that people around McLuhan recognized this guy wasn't a normal limited professor. There was something wild about him. But only people who knew him personally in Toronto. The pictures you would see of him in the newspaper and that through the late 50s or 60s, he was very conservative looking. Very business. You wouldn't think he was a beatnik professor. You see what I'm saying? I'm saying that he's talking among his friends here.
I'm entirely sure I connect with the beatnik aesthetic, Bob, so I'm not entirely sure what.
Oh, wait, you're thinking the beatnik thing is wearing suits?
Well, I mean, I think of Ginsberg as a kind of a beatnik figure. I don't know whether that's correct. And Ginsberg, at least around that time, was often photographed wearing, you know, a fairly loose sack suit kind of thing, black sack suit, occasionally a bit
of a
tie.
Okay, but there's this whole casual clothing thing he's doing. Maybe he's not photographed that way. And you don't get the sense the guy would take the suit off, do you?
No.
Yeah. Okay, so I just find it interesting that McLuhan's image in photographs, he did not look like a beatnik sensibility. But I bet you people felt that way when they're just sitting in his class. I mean, he's teaching in 1951, according to Murray Schafer, the Canadian composer, saying things like, Finnegan's Wake is not a book, it's all radio. It's a radio program. Saying things like that is beatnik-ish or pretty wild. So I think this is among people who know him. McLuhan will not only show... Now, this is incredible. When I first read this, here he is talking about McLuhan as a third person.
Yeah, it's wild.
That's why I think he's talking among people who know him.
It's a beautiful follow-on from we've been talking about Bruce Powell and the put-on as well.
Yeah, and see, he's performed on CBC at this point. In 1960, he did that takeoff on Lolita. which I think you can see on YouTube now or on CBC, you can see some of the interesting things they did as explorations. In the exploration of food around Toronto, that Carpenter gets at. Carpenter had a TV show in the mid-50s. They were in the media. They'd be known a bit. And I think that's where he could talk about McLuhan in the third person. He'd already become a bit of a celebrity in Toronto. So that may be the context for why he can talk about himself as an image. McLuhan will not only show the relation between electronics, it's almost like they know what McLuhan's rap is, and he's making fun of what they know he's going to say because he said it many times around Toronto.
Yeah.
So he's saying, you guys now know that I will talk about the relation between electronics and the humanities, but between the small car and Bridget Bardot, I'm going to do this properly. McLuhan will not only show the relation between electronics and the humanities, but between the small car and Bridget Bardot, which is written in Understanding Media, right? These sentences. He will take off in all directions at once, proving that since the disappearance of seams from nylons, there's no value in reality. This is him describing Quadrophenia or Finneganese, and it's a put-on. Remember, he used to say, what's the difference between a takeoff and a put-on? So it's interesting how he uses the word takeoff here within the larger put-on.
Mm-hmm.
The disappearance of the line and hosiery he will make to appear, he will make to appear, as if it's a far-fetched connection, he will make to appear to be related to the disappearance of the chorus line, the receiving line, the stag line, and the party line. Now, this is where he's explaining the key sentence, radio-created depth criticism. This is another way of trying to point out, hey, all these figure, these events, this cultural changes are due to a ground.
Yes.
This is actually a better way to do it, to say he will show the connections. He will claim there's a connection between the disappearance of the chorus line, the receiving line, the stag line, and the party line. He may point to the dead omen that no child would roll the hula hoop. Now, I don't know what that means because there is hula hooping going on in 56, 57, but it's by 61 has it changed, so they're not doing the hula hoops? I don't know why he's saying that a child would not, that no child would roll it. To the dread omen.
Yeah, I got nothing on that. That's
No. I got it. I figured it out. If a child was not rolling the hula hoop, then you had a disturbed child. That's what he means. The dread omen that no child would roll a hula hoop. That means if your child didn't respond and look normal by rolling the hula hoop, you've got a problem. Isn't that what he's saying? He may point to the dread omen that no child would roll the hula hoop. It's an omen if the child wouldn't do it. He will probably suggest, now this is really funny, this is one of his best talks in the way he's presenting himself. He will probably suggest that skin diving and TV viewing are the same thing. He's actually describing the put-on that he is. He's saying that you people will see and hear this pattern where I'll talk about the hidden ground, and you will know that I'm putting you on when I talk this way. Hey, you getting this?
Yeah, I'm just following it. It's delicious.
Yeah, that the teaching machine, he will probably suggest that the teaching machines perfect the procedure of archetypal criticism. Now he's, perfect the procedure. That means the robotoid, the fused cyborg.
Yeah. That goes a long way.
Yeah. Well, perfect the procedure of archetypal criticism. And what is archetypal criticism? It's either the Northrop Frye, technically he means that, or it's the new archetypal meaning the technological ground. Because it's around this time that it's about 1961 where he first says that the satellite makes the TV become archetype. He actually says that in 61, 62. So that formula of a new technology is the last word, then it becomes cliche, then art form, then archetype. He's already working on it in 59, 60, 61. He's recognizing the effect of satellites. And he's saying we now have to, in the global theater, program the environment. The environment becomes teaching machines. So he's talking about media as art forms or teaching machines. And once you understand McLuhan, you can do archetypal criticism asleep. Because he's saying that what I can say and what I do should be obvious to you once you know how to look at figure ground relationships in media terms. If you saw what McLuhan saw and understood what he got from Innes, then you would say these kind of lectures. That's what he's saying.
Yep.
That the wraparound space of the small car and the wraparound audience of the new platform stage are not only the same form, but that North America are not only the same form, but that North America is undergoing a massive Bauhaus program of haptic innovation, which causes the leering teenager to spring up where before had grown the docile adolescent.
Yep.
So the teenager can create his own space now. This is the Lolita phenomenon that he presents in the TV show the year before. A program of haptic innovation. Now, remember what haptic, how he would illustrate haptic is when the man would make the mime the shape of a 36-24-36 woman, right? You'd caress your hands through the air. So there's a lot of caressing going on the discarnate angelic level in the satellite environment. You're programming the global media environments with information, with the news that makes the market. That's shaping the air. And that also is the prince of the air, right? Lucifer. So a program of haptic innovation. See, what is haptic innovation? It's the changes that happen in all these media that he talks about.
Yeah, the new sculpting of old environments.
Yeah, the sculpting of old environments by something that does it. Haptic is, if you think of it waving through air, it's not actually contact. It's slightly tactile. It's not the pressing on objects. It's the shaping through the gaps. Anyways, it's a very interesting phrase. So he says, but even if I avoid all these fascinating themes, there remains a great deal to be said about new roles and new procedures for the humanities in the electronic age. So he's saying,
despite this amazing stuff, I'm going to turn to what you think is a relevant but boring topic.
No, I think he's saying I will limit myself to this, to the field of humanities, and show how it is subject to haptic innovation also. Do you know what I mean? A great deal needs to be said about new roles and new procedures for the humanities electronic age. He's just saying I will specialize on one theme or one effect in one field. Rather than scanning the whole environment and doing many fields. Right? See, he's saying...
Yeah, no, I was just trying to stress the fact that despite this, he's laid out this amazing transformation, this revolution of all society. He's laid it out. Like, he's talking to these people about... he's come in and said, look, there's an incredible change, this total transformation. Things are entirely new, but this particular gathering is to look at the specialist concern. So in a certain sense, he's making fun of the fact that he's got to speak to this this singular specialist point.
Yeah, his local audience.
Yeah.
He writes in Understanding Media about how the Bauhaus School might be shocked to recognize that all of its ideals and programs were implemented by television by the late 50s. And so you actually, this quotation we're getting is actually the hidden ground to Understanding Media and the Gutenberg Galaxy. He is indicating the put on of what his books will be, because he's saying things that he will say in his later books, and he says it in a nicer, more interesting way. Yeah, not a nicer, a more poetic way. A massive Bauhaus program of haptic innovation. If I recall, I know he talks about the Bauhaus and how they would be shocked that their program and ideals of the 20s is now a cliche environment.
Well, here, look, I'm looking at a letter to Hall in February 21, 1961. And he says to Hall that he's unable to convey his point concerning television as a haptic medium. And then he moves on to talk about tactility. So he appears to be sort of saying that, look, he seems to indicate that he tried to use this idea of the haptic, but found it had no purchase.
Okay, but that's in February 61. 4 months later, he does talk about it. He tries it again.
Yeah, yeah. So we're on that cusp. So he's sort of trying out that language, but he inevitably inevitably gives up on the haptic and moves into using the tactile, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, I start off saying that you hardly ever saw him use the word haptic. And I forgot about this point you're saying in the February letter. He admits that haptic was a difficult word to refer to. But the haptic is actually the non-contact part of tactility that he would emphasize as tactile.
Yeah.
So I think we – didn't we make a formula about haptic is to something as tactile? We did that. I remember doing that once, one time, right? Remember? We made this figure ground between haptic –
Yeah, I think it's on the McLuhan now. It's in the archives. People can search through and find that. I think it's quite a good pattern.
Right. So that's good, important to point out that he's having trouble for people understanding the haptic, which means the gap part of tactility is what people don't get.
Yeah, it's rather interesting as well that, like, I guess in the early 2000s, people were having trouble with McLuhan's word tactility and wanted to move back to the haptic. I know all those people that came out of Kittler and... all of those McLuhan's disciples tended to resonate with the haptic over the tactile.
Yeah, you could do a cross global figure ground analysis of how different races and cultures and academics in different languages have a different sense of plenary awareness or total mastery of McLuhan by what term they emphasize. The haptic or the tactile.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the East emphasizes the haptic and the emphasizes the tactile. And usually the Westerner, the reason tactile is more acceptable, people think tactile is contact, is touch, is the pressure point. And that is the Western interpretation of the haptic. They don't get the ma, the Japanese gap. That's what the non-Western cultures get. They get the haptic part. See, tactility is touch and then let go. The haptic indicates the let go zone, and most Americans think that tactile means the actual pressure part of touch.
Yeah, I got a good little quote on this just after he's mentioned to Hall. Sorry for the digression, Bob, but what I've become pretty sure of experimentally is that tactility has less to do with the skin than the interface of sense and faculty.
Yeah,
that
there
is
you go.
The meeting of sight and sound constitutes touch, as it also constitutes translation or metamorphosis. This term interface is now used in chemistry is very helpful. It draws attention to that mysterious aspect of culture that is both metamorphic and metaphoric and metamorphic. And then he's going on to about language's storehouse of perception.
Yeah, you should excerpt that, and that's something you put on a trophy or a masthead. That's an excellent description of the of tactility as a gap, the non-contact, the non-touching skin.
Yeah, see, but how's it as the meeting of sight and sound constitutes touch? Like, people go, "What the hell is that? What is he on?"
Yeah, that is what I say. The tactility is the interplay of the senses, not any particular sense. But the organism that organizes sensory data into coherent consciousness, what you just read is another way of saying what I try to say with what I just said. You know what I mean? I'd like to get a copy of that. What letter is that?
Yeah, I'll send it to you now.
Okay, you can just scan it. And I mean, you have it?
Yep.
Okay, because that is an excellent statement of what you have to understand. It's like you got to recognize you don't understand that, and you got to work on it. And here's the you see, when tactility came in through television, kinetic Americans interpreted that as more skin contact, and that's where the sexual revolution came from. It was a kinetic, non-haptic interpretation of tactility. Everybody started contacting skin, right? And the counterculture started to do the tactile thing by taking drugs. They went for the gap. It's in the hallucinatory interplay where touch meets sight, sense, sight and sound, and creating synesthesia. That's what people got from marijuana and LSD. That was the interior sex rather than the external sex. You get that?
Yep.
Never been said before. Okay. where so he says, but even if I avoid all these fascinating themes, there remains a great deal to be said about new roles and new procedures for the humanities in the electronic age. It was Peter Drucker, former professor of philosophy and now dean of management in New York University, which said, in other words, Drucker is an object. This object, Peter Drucker, which said, if McLuhan really means that which said, in effect, at the outset of his Landmarks of Tomorrow, I guess that's a book, quote, for the first time in human history, higher education is not a privilege, a frill, or a luxury. It is a necessity of production. All right, so McLuhan's going to interpret that. Boy, there's a long stretch here. We'll just work our way through it.
Yeah,
it's got so much good stuff in it. So we're now back to McLuhan, right? He just gives two sentences from Drucker. For the first time in human history, higher education is not a privilege, a frill, or a luxury. It is a necessity of production. McLuhan translates, this is not to say that higher education is being supplanted by commerce, but rather that the age-old gap between them is harder to find. In a recent book, Classrooms in the Factories, Clark and Sloan report that the annual budget for classroom teaching in industry is more than four times the annual budget for primary, secondary, and higher education. And that estimate takes no account of the extensive training programs for military personnel. The General Electric Management Center for Executive Training at Crotonville on the Hudson has four classes of 40 executives each year. The budget is $46 million. Drucker, never did he know the true... What is this? So I guess he's quoting Drucker saying that never did Drucker know the true meaning of liberal education, says Peter Drucker in the book already mentioned, Landmarks of Tomorrow, until he entered the field of management consulting. In other words, he didn't realize there was so much education going on outside of the university or classroom in industry, mm-hmm. right, until he had contact with them. He refers to the immediate relevance of encyclopedic liberal knowledge in the conduct of current corporation design and action. Indeed, the corporations are much more aware of their need for new high-level liberal education than are the universities. The Ciceronian ideal of the doctor's orator is current again. In The Liberal Hour by Kenneth Galbraith, Galbraith has a chapter on, quote, economics and art, unquote, in which he both ridicules the old commercial notion of art as frivolity and urges the relevance of art as a navigational guide in all business today. The supremacy of design in creating a marketing is one factor. The other factor is that the artist's designs provide the advanced models of future development, or he just says provide the advanced models future development. Careful study of new artistic models gives any firm 10 or 20 years breathing spell in planning and development. The old-fashioned businessman who played it off the cuff and read only the current signs is now doomed by the speed of the new technology. So the artist moves from the ivory tower to the control tower in modern industry. He has not often explained that statement. The artist goes from ivory tower to the control tower. It's one time when he fills in some details.
Yep.
Now, a lot of what he's saying actually doesn't hold water within 5 years. Things even get more rapid. I don't know what to say.
What I was just struck with as you were going through that was, I guess, the place and significance of Bernard Muller-Thein in terms of McLuhan's development. Because he was one of the first, as I understand, the medievalists that took McLuhan under his wing. And he was a medievalist and really pointed out the need that business has for medieval and or humanist and arts education and insights.
Right, and it's Muller time, I think. I pronounce it time, not time.
Well, you probably say it correctly.
Muller
never
time.
Had to say that word to anybody.
Beg your pardon?
I've never had to say that name out loud to anybody, Bob.
Okay, I think it's in the Marchand biography or somewhere is that Muller time taught McLuhan tactility. The Thomas notion, the tactile aspect of Thomism. I think he learned that from Muller-Thein. I mean, he learned a lot from Muller-Thein, but the whole medieval thing they may have learned more from Muller time than Gilson and Maritain. That's what Mark Stallman misses.
Yeah, well, particularly insofar as he's setting the medievalist in immediate relation to contemporary business issues. And I think that cannot be underrated.
Well, he has an essay in the early 70s, are we in a medieval environment? Has it been retrieved? He doesn't often have a question in an article headline. It means that we're not in a medieval environment. It's just that that's all the people remember in their memory theater that approximates the new elephant they're looking at in their living room.
Yep.
They're mistaking it as a retrieval medievalism. Now, the retrieval medievalism is in the tetrad. It is in some aspects of the environment, but there's also a whole new thing that's going on. That's not medieval. He gets at that with listing all the changes we just read, the stag line, the soup line, all that linear stuff that collapses. And he also here is still talking. See, he's talking to the humanists who believe that there's relevance to liberal education. And he's actually putting them on, making them feel better. Remember he said that he first came up with the statement, the medium is the message, at a conference of radio broadcasters in 1957, where the ostensible mood was that they were panicking that TV was going to put them all out of business. And he told them that no medium disappears. You will just have to do different roles and have different functions. So he's telling the humanists that they're going to have new roles at best, but he doesn't tell them that, but that's what he would say. He's got panic in liberal humanists, and he tries to give them a optimistic outlook.
Yep, okay.
He doesn't, the deeper you understand McLuhan, he's actually putting them on, but he's going on about liberal education and how encyclopedic information creators in the information society are forced to be. But he was writing about the encyclopedic tradition back in 1946 when he's talking about the rhetorical encyclopedic grammarian is more relevant to the 20th century than the dialectician. It's the comprehensive generalism or broad acquaintance with many fields that are necessary for just surviving in the corporate world. So he's actually throwing, he drops this kind of talk when he's talking to someone else. Yeah, he's forced to coddle these guys. Say, oh, there's lots of roles for you guys. And in 5 years, everybody's whacked out on LSD and run around with Allen Ginsberg and the Beatles and Jim Morrison. and signing up groups like the Mothers of Invention because the managers of the record companies don't understand what's going on.
So they must be where it's at.
Yeah, it's changing. It changes from 61 to 65. Great changes. It's like 500 years happens. This is almost, I remember Peter Montgomery saying he was a student of Marshall around 62, and he noticed that Marshall, as a young mind, just noticing Marshall, he noticed that he seemed to be not so tolerant of literary criticism and the humanist enterprise in 62, 63. He's going to drop all that. And remember, the literary criticism goes from 43 to 62. This is like McLuhan in the late 40s, what we did in the previous item. He's still trying to figure out how to keep the critical enterprise going in the tradition of depth criticism. We now have him 10 years later wondering whether the new Earweek split is whether to even to give hope to the liberal humanist tradition. See, you're going to move into no longer needed is the encyclopedic manager, what you need now is a caveman, someone who's post-literate, who's actually in a panic state. Because this is just before, let's see, June 61.
Yeah, things start getting pretty brutal, don't they, in the mid sort of 60s.
In America, yeah. You have the Bay of Pigs is April 61. So the Bay of Pigs has happened. Maybe people don't realize how that devastating is to the presidential image by June. But in 62, you've got the Cuban Missile Crisis. You got the mafia and other elements planning to assassinate Kennedy. Then you have, what's his name, Martin Luther King speaking in the summer of 63 in front of the White House. And that famous gathering. And 64 and 65, the Civil Rights Movement. America is going to be totally different, at least in the TV landscape, within 2 years. This still has a 50s aura to it. He would talk about this kind of stuff in the 50s, the liberal humanist tradition. But he's now, see, this is what he's doing. He's making fun of the 50s McLuhan when he's talking the first part about McLuhan would say this and that and lay out the figure ground effects. He's actually, this is a new insight. This is evidence of the change Peter Montgomery saw in him. He was upping the ante on his put on. He was going total cyborg as figure.
I'll go and explore that one, Bob. I'm not sure about that one straight away.
I think this is the beginning of the later McLuhan. This is where he's tossing off the early, not the literate early mechanical bride McLuhan. He's tossing off the liberal, the early media ecologist. Now, he'll keep doing this for the teachers' organizations and the Rotary groups or Kiwanis groups, but he ain't doing this when he gets on TV or when he's down in New York City talking to the artists or to writing letters to the scientists and to Martin saying, hey, the second coming is here. The prince of the air is reigning supreme. It's apocalyptic.
Yeah.
It's Armageddon. This is interesting. Just seeing that, yes, he's tossing off the early. So we knew we have the early. You have early critic, no, early depth critic McLuhan in the late 30s. Then later depth critic is what we did at the beginning of Conscious Meanship and. And whatever other quotes we used in the previous item. That's the late 40s. That's late depth critic. Now we have early media ecologist in the 50s, and then you have later media ecologists in the 60s. And in true form, he's responding to the space race. Sputnik goes up in 57. I think Telstar goes up in 62. So he's responding to also the fact he was on TV.
That's some pretty wild Louisian two-ness going on there, Bob.
Yeah, on my part or his part?
Both on your part and on McLuhan's part, if your theory holds water.
Yeah, he's intuiting Quadrophenia. But what was I saying? He has been on TV. He was ill when he does that TV thing, and he looks very bad in the TV explorations thing that... The content of it is outlined in Project 69. The actual, you can find in the addenda at the back of Project 69 in June 1960, right? So this is a year later. So this, and he's testing out his dropping of the McLuhan thing among his friends in Toronto. See, this is a rehearsal for the Global Theater stage later when he gets to New York.
Okay, well, let's get back into the text.
All right, if you insist. Let's see. So the artist moves from the ivory tower to the control tower in modern industry. He's now envisioning, because he's writing in 61 how we need a global city. And the global city begins at the air traffic controller tower at the airport. All right? The new airports are being built across North America at this point. And he's getting to see them as he flies around. And the pentatic manager, the android meme, cyborgian manager playing with the tetrad is now beginning to take over at the airport, the control tower at the airport. You know that image, right?
Yes.
You remember that letter?
Yeah.
It's important. He is actually starting to say his – these are the kind of perspectives that Ted Carpenter doesn't like. He doesn't like the non-aesthetic or post-aesthete McLuhan, where he starts monitoring the global environments and dropping books and on Venezuela and cutting off radio from China. You know what I mean? He's starting to intuit this, and he has to have that together because he's going to map it out in Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. He's going to have that as a punchline in Understanding Media. So this is very telling speech. He continues, with regard to the new needs of industry in the electronic age, a recent spokesman insisted that one out of every 10 elementary school children must proceed to a PhD if the American situation is to be maintained, no matter what the area of study be, so it be done in depth. That is the vision of American business and education today, for good or ill. See, that's the radio content. That's depth criticism. Depth criticism becomes available to everybody. He then realizes later in the global theater, he may be starting to realize it now, that depth criticism is your average citizen. Your average citizen is depth critic. Being forced to live in a multi-level style. Remember, by mid-60s, he's saying...
There's also a dimension of the simplicity, for want of... to use Frank Zangroni's term, which I thought had at least some use value... The idea that you've come out of a situation where a mechanical situation where people can actually fix stuff, and probably can still even fix their TV screen or fix their radio, and well, 61 things are, you've got to have a PhD to to actually create and maintain that environment.